Hello, welcome to Hollywood Ungagged, Scotland's premier political podcast for lefties. Yet another action-packed week in Scottish politics. We had our imperial lord and masters from the royal family come up to visit us in their charm offensive against independence. I'm sure that was a great comfort to the 500 workers at Tollcrosses McVitie's factory that are facing redundancy. We also had the explosive testimony of Dominic Cummins, who explained to us that the guy that he put in number 10 was completely unfit for the job. And then with the surprising news that the SNP and the Greens are negotiating a possible cooperation agreement. There was also a sad part of the week when news broke that the last international brigader that fought in the Spanish Civil War died at the age of 102. So that's what we'll be talking about this week. If there's anything you think we should be talking about, tweet us at _ungagged, hashtag Holyrood Ungagged, or drop us an email at ungaggedleft@gmail.com, putting Holyrood Ungagged in the subject line. I'll be your host today, David McClement. I'm transmitting from the Blantyre Free State. I'm the only member of the Green Party that doesn't own a bike. Joining me is the old reliable of the Holyrood podcast, the digital Michelangelo of Nogai, Miss Deborah Torrens, and also we'll be welcoming back the prodigal son of the Holyrood podcast, the Pizza Hut prince, Mr. Brian Stewart Finlay. And with all that said, let's get ungagged. Welcome, guys. Another fun, action-packed week in Scottish politics. How are you doing? Enjoying the sunshine and this lovely bank holiday weekend?
Yes, I've been watering the plants and blew up the paddling pool so the dog could put his paws in it. It was very exciting.
I've been out for a walk. I've got the factor 50 on my bald head. it's all good.
Good. Anyway, like I said, it's been an action-packed week, so we better get started. So the first up was we had a lovely visit from Mr. and Mrs. of Cambridge, the Duke and Duchess, the second in line to the throne, came up to kind of a charm offensive, it was described, in order to convince us that we're better off in the UK. So were you charmed?
I was charmed by their lovely tartan. They're always dress up like shortbread tins, don't they? And they come up to Scotland. It's like to show you.
The natives love that. The natives love that.
Exactly. We love that. Wear more tartan. Yeah, no, I wasn't particularly charmed. I didn't really follow much of it at heart. I kind of read it in hindsight and what they got up to, and I was just like, so nothing, basically. So no, I was not charmed at all. But yeah, it was very much quite superficial, very much, you know, showing off, you know, coming up, doing a wee visit and then just going away again. So definitely not charmed.
Can you tell how enthused we all are about the monarchy? We're like,
normally the first kind of topic is like, yeah, it's like chat, and it's just like, oh, do you want to go? Do you want to talk?
We're absolutely buzzing.
What did you think, David?
I saw some of the sort of reporting of it from like the Telegraph and some of the kind of Tory papers for down south, and it was bizarre because they were so enthusiastic. You know, this was like, you know, independence is finished as far as they could see, like, because I don't know, William and his bird came up and visited a couple of what did they go again? They visited a social care sort of project in North Lanarkshire. I can't try to even remember where else they went. They went to one of their palaces, I'm sure. Yeah, but the Telegraph had a big story about Kate Middleton's dresses and all the different dresses that she'd wore and how important, apparently, this was to, you know, strengthening the union. So apparently the strength of the union is built on 20 dresses that came to a collective amount of £8,035, according to the Telegraph.
Wow. Bargain.
And, well, I mean, that the blue one with the belt was nice, but, I mean, it's certainly not going to save the union. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can see Peacocks doing that next season, you know, something like that. But, you know, nice dress, saving the union, nah.
They watched even though it was
the colours of the soul tile.
Yeah, they watched some Highland dancing, didn't they? That was.
Of course they did.
They were probably judging it because, you know, William's such a renowned Highland dancer expert. I just think it was quite cynical. Like, they're coming up to sort of tell us how wonderful it is in the union. Look at this, you know, prince and princess and what a wonderful nuclear family they have. And they're going to rule over all of us at some point. It's a bit depressing, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think the whole, you know, if we're going to use the royal family as some sort of, I don't know, advert for the union, it just shows how little research they actually do. Because actually, I know that there's a lot, like, I mean, there's been a lot of sort of behavioural analysis. There was a great piece last year in Open Democracy about how in Scotland in general, there's not a huge amount of difference of views, you know, about certain domestic policies, economic policies and stuff between Scotland and England and the rest of the UK. But one thing that there is a huge difference is about the British state. So it's about the monarchy. It's about it actions towards the empire, all these types of things. So you think, why didn't you just not do that? I just don't understand, like, you know, why you would choose something like the monarchy to try and bind a union together when actually it's one thing that we don't necessarily agree with. I think it just shows just superficial, shallow, not very well researched. So basically the whole Tory campaign of trying to keep a union together, just personified, I think.
Yeah, and it just kind of like shows how little they understand Scotland and reinforce sort of why independence is really necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I was down visiting friends, like sort of in London and Hertfordshire this week, which was lovely. And that, ironically, is one of the places where the highest support for the royal family is. So just speaking to people in Hertfordshire, some of my friends or like your older family members and stuff, like, you know, when there was the royal wedding, they're like, you know, having a street party, you know, these types of things. And to me, it's just so alien, you know, coming from central Scotland. And I was like, oh, that's nice. It sounds lovely. And then, you know, just looking at how different the sort of attitudes are amongst working class people in that particular area versus up here, I think it just shows real misunderstanding of where ordinary people's are. I think a lot of people are just so ambivalent towards the royal family generally. And so I just don't think if you're going to, you know, use something that's in your arsenal to I don't know, bolster the union, it's not the royal family.
Yeah, there was another aspect to the visit that actually, I don't even know if we would have spoke about it, if I'm honest, if it wasn't for the bit. It was an interesting tweet from Christian Gurumurti of Channel 4, who said that they'd managed to catch on film Gordon Brown having a secret meeting with the royals while they were up here. And even more astounding, they'd been told that they weren't allowed to actually make the footage public.
Oh, do you notice on it?
Mm-hmm. I never went into details, but just, and a lot of people were speculating exactly what law exactly would they be allowed to use to do that, but he says they weren't allowed to do it. So there must have been some kind of, he clearly wasn't happy about it, so there must have been some kind of legal enforcement.
But talking about being out of touch, imagine going and meeting Gordon Brown to see the union.
He's the man to give us an insight.
Devo Max plus plus.
Devo Max plus crowns. You know, like, it's just, yeah, again, going back to definitely to the out of touch argument is, you know, Gordon Brown is sometimes kind of wheeled out as like a sort of saviour for unionism. We've seen it just before the Holyrood election as well for Labour. Yeah. Not really much to be said on that either, really.
You can just imagine royal advisors saying, well, they must understand Scotland. I mean, listen to that accent.
Yeah, he used to represent Kirkcaldy and Cowdenbeath. They're going to listen to him, you know. I don't know. It's yeah. But the fact that they're saying that they can't show that footage. And the reason why they don't want to show that footage is in itself quite interesting. But, you know, because what position does Gordon Brown actually hold? Not much. We know that, you know, there would be representatives of the Scottish government would be in contact with the royal family whilst they're on a visit and these types of things. But it just seems a bit bizarre that we've got the Prime Minister from 11 years ago just meeting. It's just quite odd.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, how often are we told that the strength of the royal family is that they're non-political and that they're above politics? And I suppose the fact that this was tried to keep secret is really to preserve that facade because, you know, with the leak during the Indire from part that the Queen apparently said to somebody and it was just happened to be caught by a reporter that Scottish voters should be very careful about what they vote for in this independence referendum. You know, and yet we're told that she's not political until they need her to be, and then she's very political along with the rest of it.
It depends what hat she's wearing when she's reading the stuff. You know, that's meant to be a European Union flag, you know, all these subtle little hints. But yeah, I do remember that front page. I think it was at the Sun or the Daily Record or something, wasn't it, just before the Indy referendum. It just so happened to be that the Queen said, oh, you know, voters should be careful. And it was overheard and then slapped across the front pages, you know, 2 days before people go to vote. So yeah, I mean, they have meant to be apolitical, but that in itself is potentially quite political. I don't know. Like, it's
can you really be a head of state and be apolitical? You
know, no. Or what, just compliant and follow orders?
In which case, what's the point?
What is the point?
Well, they probably quite like their shooting estates and coming up to their big palaces, going a wee staycation, you know, up to the Highlands and see the peasants. Sorry, pheasants. No, pheasants. Aye, shooting them.
Get the old kilt out the wardrobe and dress up.
That's that exactly.
Dress up, get, you know, ex-prime ministers round, get some pictures taken, you know. This is how fabulous.
With legal action.
You know, just like any old visit.
We've all done it.
We've all been there. But, yeah, the whole thing just seems really quite bizarre, doesn't it? And it just seems so artificial and just really superficial and artificial, and it's just not attractive. Of course, coming from my perspective, I'm pretty biased, but to me it's just seems a bit daft and pointless and really miscalculated on the unionist side too. So on you go, guys, keep going. We get Boris Johnson up next week. There we go. It's a good idea.
Did you see the new ship of state just while we're having a wee bash into the royals? £200 million new boat, which I can only describe as what looks like a level in Call of Duty. Like, it's a villain, a Bond villain's boat.
I haven't seen any pictures, but it's just like, it just seems as if it's like Groundhog Day. Every couple of years, it comes up saying, oh, we need another royal yacht. It's like, what is the Tories' obsession with buying the Queen a big boat? I mean, why do they want to do it so much?
It's really strange because I saw something on one of these sort of news coverages and they're like, yeah, it's to replace the Royal Yacht Britannia, which went out of service in 1997. And I was like, well, that was a while ago. Like, if only we had the Britannia just now, where are we going to hold that function? Yeah. It's just, you know, if I had to replace something for 24 years ago, I would think, probably didn't need it.
Aye. They said it's going to promote British industry, be a place for diplomats to meet up. And I was just thinking, that's like one of those, Ferrero Rocher ambassador parties. That's exactly what's going to be happening. Them all flouncing about, you know, off the coast of Europe because they're bad.
I did see a tweet not long before we started the podcast, and I didn't look into it close enough to find out if the guy was being serious or if it was quite a clever joke, but he was hailing what a great idea this boat was going to be, and he was saying, can you imagine as it sails into all these foreign capitals and how it will impress them, and just imagine sailing into Berlin and Paris and Canberra. And it's somebody was pointing out all of the capital cities are way inland, so they're not going to be that impressed.
Yeah, if you can sail into Paris, that would be amazing. To be honest,
they wanted to call it the HMS Duke of Edinburgh, and the palace said, no, So we need a name, a new name.
I think that's boat. Really disrespectful.
To to the boat.
just
to
in general.
Call it that, or do you not call it that? Because I don't know, they could go either way.
Everybody just seems to say that, you know, when somebody disagrees with something, but they don't actually follow it up. So it's just that, you know, it's for the listener to decide. It's just really disrespectful.
I mean, what can you say? You know, like food banks, people struggling left and right. And right away, the Tories want to build a £200 million boat for the richest women in the world.
Yeah, and also whack more Union Jacks on planes as well. Was it not like the you know, there was the you know, the Prime Minister's plane, was it last year, was like, you know, repainted to have a really bad Union Jack painted on it. Yeah. Not even a nice one, but a really bad one. And then it was like the Typhoon jets came out with two little flaps with Union Jacks on it. And I was just like, eh?
What's that for? You know,
I don't know.
Like, if it's just aesthetic, like, I don't think you're going to see it through the ground or anything. It's just it's Union Jackery. Did you see the AI bus in London that looks like a squashed soda can? Have you seen that one?
Yes, I've seen that.
Yeah, was that a driverless bus or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. It looked terrible, not just because it was a Union Jack. It was like, they'll literally stick a Union Jack on anything. I mean, that could be a competition. Who can find the most crazy example of a Union Jack stuck in the most random object?
Jerry Halliwell.
I was going to say Ian Murray, but
there you go. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's just Union Jackery going a little bit crazy. And then, of course, when the Royals come up to Scotland, it's tartan craziness. You know, it's just symbols stuck everywhere.
It's just such a twee sort of boring, safe, unreal image of what they think Scotland's about. You know, a Scotland that Sir Walter Raleigh created and never really existed and hasn't existed since, but that's what Scotland is to them. It's hairy coos and, you know, tartan on everything.
And Hannah's a hairy ginger people.
No offence, Brian.
Hello.
I think that's very disrespectful.
You've got a ginger really beard there, uh-huh. David.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got a bit of ginger as well. I think we're all a wee bit ginger.
So basically the Royals are right, is that what you're saying?
Aye, they must be.
We are all ginger. The Ginger Podcast.
The Wee Ginger Podcast.
Just getting back a wee bit to the politicisation of the Royals, because that is one of the myths about them being outside of politics, when it's been revealed loads of times that, you know, whether it's Prince Charles writing all these letters to cabinet ministers over years and years, like getting them to drop certain things and change certain things in upcoming laws, or just the fact that the Queen has to approve of every law. So, you know, you pass a law that's going to negatively affect her finances and she gets the last call on it, you know. I bet we'd all wish they have that sort of option.
Yeah, I think basically just having, you know, a figurehead, a head of state who's apparently not political, just seems daft, but it's not political. But as you say, every legislation from every devolved parliament, from Westminster, it goes through Royal Assent as the last stage. You know, I'm not aware of any policy that's been stopped at Royal Assent, but it's just the fact that it goes through this sort of just protocol was just really quite, it's just ridiculous.
Like, it's performance, yeah. it's performance theatre. That's what I think a lot of the systems we hold. Like the whole, you know, the Scottish Parliaments, when we spoke about it before, when the members of Parliament were swearing in, how they still take an oath of allegiance to Her Majesty and her heirs and graces. And it's like, come on now, it's 2021. It's time for a republic.
Anyway, yeah,
that's the thing. I mean, post-independence, I feel as if that will be one of the first things in the agenda. It'll be the next referendum after we win IndyRef will definitely be about the Royals.
I certainly hope so. And I think that, you know, to continue into an independent nation and still want to hold an old institution like the royal family is just really, you know, if anyone holds that position, is really, really strange and doesn't really make much sense. And then, you know, you go, there's so many people who are royalists and support the royal family, saying, you know, it's great for tourism, etc., 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 which there's no real tangible evidence to support that, because it's impossible to know the motivations of tourists, why they choose to come here. But it's almost like saying, well, what, nobody visits Ireland or nobody visits like France. In fact, Paris converted their palaces into public galleries and museums and all these types of things. Well, there's an argument for that. And then, like, what, does nobody visit America? Like, it's just crazy.
That's always the sort of statistic that really undermines that argument, is when you say that the most popular, most visited mm-hmm. royal palace in Europe is Versailles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm only saying we should have a referendum to get rid of the royals. I'm not saying we go around the same route as the French.
No, absolutely not. But it's, you know, we could have a referendum, and then, you know, if we choose to get rid of the monarchy, then they can go on the social housing waiting list like everyone else.
I'm just looking into doing a new business startup on guillotines.
Yeah.
Anybody wants to get in that, get in touch. Talking about
the whole thing about guillotines, a business, you only need to use them once.
No returns policy.
If you do it right.
You almost ruined my segue there, because I was saying, I was going to say, talking about getting the chop, what about McVitie's?
Yeah, well, I'm sure the 500 workers that are now facing redundancy at the McVitie's plant in Toll Cross, I'm sure it would have been a great comfort to see all of Kate's lovely 8 grand dresses mm-hmm. When they're facing an uncertain future. So, yeah, the McVitie's factory in Toll Cross, it's been there for 100 years, and without warning, all the workers have just been told that they're shutting the place out of a job.
Yeah, I was reading a tweet, and it was from one of the workers, and it just said, in less than 10 minutes, a totally unexpected statement was read out to McVitie's Toll Cross workers. And as you say, it's 100 years of employment in the area. My auntie worked in McVitie's in Toll Cross. She used to get all the broken biscuits at the end of her shift. We'd get some of them. But walking around Toll Cross Park, no, having that burning biscuit smell, it's very sad. And those people, that what can you say? It's just capitalism, isn't it?
It is. And there's a really, for anyone listening, there's a really, really good piece, and not a paper that I normally pick up, but in the Sunday Post today. And they've interviewed a couple of the workers, particularly people that have worked there, somebody for 46 years, I think it is. And wow. Basically talking about how, you know, she walked into the factory in the 1970s and was basically just asked to fill in an application form. There was always jobs there. That was one of the quotes in there. And then just over the years, it's like slowly cutting the staff. And of course, they went into that meeting expecting it to be, oh, more redundancies. But everybody was actually really, really shocked. And that's, you know, that makes it even worse. You know, it's not like there's been rumours of closure for a long time. Not that that makes it any easier. But I just thought that was really, really good context to put it into, like actually how it's changed so much since the 1970s. So it's just absolutely horrific. And looking at more analysis of the McVitie's factory in Toll Cross, is actually apparently, so even if you use a capitalist argument to try and save this factory, it's one of their most productive units. But it also hasn't had the same investment as what other factories have had. So during the pandemic, you know, these people were going to work. They were deemed as essential workers because of their food production. And they've gone through all of this. And, you know, as Glasgow is still obviously in level 3, you know, we're kind of getting towards the end of these, this phase of restrictions anyway. And to be given this news, I think it's really, really bad. And there's, you know, some of the unions are saying that perhaps it's actually been constructed, you know, over time to basically close this particular factory down. So it's really, really quite concerning for these workers, and, you know, particularly for that area, I think will be even more problematic with the level of unemployment in Glasgow and in the east of Glasgow.
Right, well, Campbell's Soup was, you know, that was shut down in Shettleston as well. So, you know, these are, you know, hundreds of jobs in Glasgow's East End, which is already a really area of high deprivation and unemployment, and we really should be having more investment from these companies rather than, you know, shutting down their factories. And where are they going if it's one of their highest production outlets. Where are they going to start making this instead, if not?
I think they've got another 5 factories in England, and they said they will just be transferring production to those. And McVitie's is not, I mean, a lot of companies have been struggling during the pandemic, for what I've been told. You know, McVitie's are not one of them. You know, if anything, during the pandemic, I've certainly ate more biscuits in the last year than the year before.
Who's not?
Food production in general has done really well. And I know that, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there is a high profit figure for McVitie's. During that time, I think it's like, you know, actual revenue is like £2 billion or something like that. Really, really high. And particularly if they're, you know, choosing this really productive site, which actually has been the workers that have done that without as much investment from the employer. And I think that this is what we tend to miss in this sort of day of analysis when we talk about businesses closing. We always talk to, you know, the business. We look at it through the prism of a business argument. Oh, well, it's not very productive. It's not this, it's not that. But actually, we need to really shine a light on these people and these experiences of these workers, particularly over the history. And really just say, well, actually, it's these workers that have made it productive. It's these workers that have, you know, gone through a pandemic, turned up to work, you know, and essentially turned around the fortune of that factory at one point because the production increased without the investment from the organisation. And it's just so frustrating. And the quote that sticks out is that the workers were saying, it's just a kick in the teeth.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never really thought much about it, but I didn't know that McVitie's was a Scottish company originally. I suppose should have guessed it by the name, but but I think that's all the production will be gone in Scotland now after being founded in 1830 in Edinburgh. But it's so depressing because it's such a familiar story. I mean, we can name loads of companies where things like this have happened. I know certainly when I grew up, the Hoover factory used to employ thousands, and just over decades, mm-hmm. just slowly shed a couple 100 jobs here, 100 jobs there. So it got to the point there was, you know, a fraction of the individual workers there. When they eventually did shut it down, it really didn't make that much of a ripple because it was just a shadowy of what it had been at one time. I was just going to say that that's capitalism. It's like decisions get made way, way above the people that are affected by them based on factors that they've got no control over. And, you know, a couple of strokes of a pen and people's lives are turned upside down. It's not fair.
Yeah. And really, when it comes down to a full factory closing down as well, that the senior managers and management too that have been, you know, overseeing this production and basically trying to make it as profitable as possible and putting pressure on workers, you know, and essentially sticking up for the capitalist organisation, they're getting shafted and all. So it's, you know, it is just capitalism 101, that the only person that is going to benefit here is the people at the top. And it's unfortunate that it falls on people, particularly in areas of high deprivation, particularly in areas that have lost so much manufacturing during deindustrialization that pay the highest price.
Deborah, were you going to say something there?
Yeah, I was just going to ask about, do any of you know about any union action? Like, is the workers trying to do a buyout, or is the Scottish
I don't know the details, but I know you can follow what's happening on Twitter on @save_jobs, and they've launched a petition which had thousands and thousands of signatures. I've signed it.
I've signed it.
So
I'll go and sign it too.
Yeah, so anybody listening, if you can find them on Twitter, you'll be able to find a petition through that and get signing. And any other support that we can give, I'm happy to offer. And I hope we get a decent outcome for the men and women that work there.
I know that Unite is, I think they represent about 100 workers there, and I've seen GMB putting out some information about it too. So I know that these unions are involved in it, but I think at the moment, because it is still at the sort of negotiation stage, I think the workers are feeling, first of all, shocked, but feeling a little bit powerless at the moment. So hopefully we can see, there seems to be support from SNP and Labour politicians that I've seen tweeting about it. So it seems to be that there's going to be quite a lot of broad support for this. So hopefully that the political pressure will be successful.
Also, what happened this week with the explosive testimony from Dominic Cummins to the parliamentary committee today, where he savaged his old boss and pal Boris Johnson and some other members of the cabinet. What were your thoughts? It was quite something to see.
I watched quite a lot of this just because I found it really, really interesting. I didn't watch it all because it was like 7 hours or something total. And I read some of the key things. I think Dominic Cummins himself as a character is something to be mindful of. Yeah, so everything that was said is through his perception as a libertarian, very right wing, and somebody with an axe to grind. So I think that, you know, but a lot of the things that he was saying make sense. And I think that that in itself is really quite telling. I think, you know, the sort of dithering in March for the initial lockdown, and then, you know, the kind of tussling with the second lockdown in September, where they didn't do the circuit breaker, and then, you know, the 2 ages to finally decide to go into lockdown again. It fits the narrative. But what I thought with the kind of focus on, you know, the sort of characters of individuals, it really just came across as like a real axe to grind with particular individuals. And I don't know if that itself kind of undervalues how important some of the things that he was saying. And he very much focuses on numbers of people dying. Well, it's not just about, you know, oh, we could have saved, you know, 10,000 people if we'd done this. Like, these are actually people's lives. People are grieving. People are really upset. And it's like, well, you were actually in a position of power. You could have whistleblew this. You could have stopped this from happening. You could have come public and resigned, which would have put more political pressure on the government. Or you could have encouraged, you know, a kind of unity government or something. And it's almost like, well, I watched all this happen and it was really terrible. And so a year later, you know, more than a year later, I'm just going to come out and character assassinate people. It's just, yeah. I mean, it was really quite, you know, a dramatic, you know, situation in a select committee, which are not exciting ever. but what's going to be even more exciting in about 2 weeks' time is that Matt Hancock is going to sit in front of the same committee. So I think that in itself will be an interesting watch.
Did you see his whiteboard? I quite like the whiteboard. Because when I first thought it, I'm very much a doodler and scribbler. I like the wee mountain at the bottom with the wee man climbing up it. I don't know if that was actually part of the plan or whatever this was. Because at first I thought, well, maybe this is a risk matrix or something where they're, you know, figuring out all the worst case scenarios. But when you actually read through the whiteboard, it's nonsense with just some random words. It's like more of like a storm session than an actual government dealing with a global pandemic. Like, I was really astounded by that when he whipped it out, you know, like, here's my whiteboard. This is what we were working off. And a lot of the decisions that they were making, he quite openly says, oh, well, we were doing it under the mindset of, we're not going to be closing any pubs, we're not going to be, you know, shutting down any retail. And then he was sort of justifying it, like, so really it made sense. And, you know, when you were in that mindset, it's like, no, because you knew this was all happening. There should have been. He also kept saying about Boris Johnson thinking it was just going to be like swine flu and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, swine flu was pretty bad, you mm-hmm. know. You should have had at least some sort of emergency response already in place that you could have just adapted a bit, because, you know, Corona was so severe. And it was just, it really highlighted to me the ineptitude of the British government. And it's scary. It's scary to think that they're all backs. When he was out checking his eyeballs up at Bernard Castle, he was totally protected and all that. And then he thinks his, you know, Prime Minister's got his back, and then he just stabs him in it anyway. It's like, how do they function as a workplace?
A lot of the stuff was stuff that in the last year we've all sort of speculating about, that yeah. they were, you know, they didn't know what they were doing, that they were sort of all over the place, more interested in like their own careers and political rivalries and making money for certain donors than actually, you know, saving people's lives and dealing with the crisis. But it's really something to hear somebody that was actually in the room confirm it all and confirm that we weren't exaggerating in our sort of speculation. They were as shambolic and as chaotic and as incompetent as we all feared that they were.
That ultimately that we all knew they were, you know, when these decisions were, you know, like, you know, there was times where we were like, the schools haven't shut yet, we haven't done this, we haven't done that, and it was actually getting to really bad, you know, situation with the numbers just constantly rising and rising, and you're thinking these guys just don't know what they're doing. And it's and I get a little bit frustrated too, and I know it's not the opposition's fault, right? So I'm not going to start, you know, blaming the Labour Party as such. But during this whole time, I mean, you know, Emily Thornberry was on Question Time on Thursday, and it was almost like, yeah, we know how scary it was, and there was no playbook for this, there was no experience of this, it was something completely new that was happening in March. And I was like, it wasn't. Like, this has happened in countries before. Like, you look at the countries that have had this situation before, Korea, you know, China, and we actually seen it coming over the hill from January. And it's like, you know, oh, well, we know it must have been really confusing and difficult for the government. No, no. Like, you know, you can understand if they, you know, they tried to do all these things to do in this country, but we don't have the infrastructure or the practices of doing these things. And, you know, they didn't quite get it right, but they didn't even try. You know, so I'm getting a bit worried with this narrative that we're seeing, particularly from the opposition, the saying, well, we're going to let the first one slide, you know, the first lockdown slide, but oh, the second lockdown, which did kill a lot more people, that's the one we're going to focus on. I was like, well, no, I think we should rewind it all the way back to January. And when we were all watching, you know, my mum's chatting to me on the phone saying, oh, you've been watching Good Morning Britain, there's this cruise ship, you know, all these people are really unwell, you know, this is way back in sort of end of January, February. And it's like, why would the government not thinking maybe we need to phone up a country that's dealt with a pandemic like this before and start planning? And then, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before, Italy is in lockdown, their health system is collapsing, and still nothing. That's just completely unforgivable.
Yeah, it's not just sort of a failure of the sort of managerial sort of aspect of government in terms of the individuals and the party that was actually in charge. It showed that the actual British state is so fragile and kind of hopeless.
Yeah.
When I was at uni, I studied immunizology and microbiology. And quite a few of the classes, pandemics, I didn't pass, so don't be too impressed. But a lot of the classes, they spoke about pandemics. And every single lecturer that mentioned it all said the same thing. It's not a case of, if this happens again, it's when. They said that this will definitely happen again at some point in the future, almost certainly in your lifetimes. So when this was unfolding and you saw what was happening in China and you saw it in Italy, which made it seem a bit more real because it was getting closer. And I kept saying to people, I says, there'll be a plan for this. I thought there'll be a filing cabinet somewhere with a kind of dusty old sort of folder that they'll have to take out and brush off and update a wee bit and see what's still applicable. But there'll be a game plan for this. How naive is that?
And but unfortunately there was Cygnus. Yeah. Was it Cygnus? Yeah, 2016?
I was just going to say that came to light during the whole PPE scandal, didn't it? That they were forewarned you know there's going to be systemic failure and the governance of this country if you don't do these things, and nobody done them.
Yeah. And you've got Tory ministers, was it Grant Shapps that was on Question Time last week, saying that, you know, oh, we didn't have the capabilities to manufacture PPE in this country. What? Like, as if that's just okay. Like, you know, but we do now. Well, can we make sure we keep that, please? Like, you know, just, but it's true. Like like you say, it will happen again. It might not be as severe. It might be worse. It might be something completely different. But these types of things will happen again. And, you know, the assumptions that were made, you know, going back to the Cummings evidence, saying that, you know, we need to go for this sort of herd immunity approach to start off with, which apparently never happened, but it did happen. And, you know, because the, you know, people in Britain are not going to abide by social distancing, they're not going to, you know, accept wearing masks and things like that. Well, maybe if you just made a concrete decision and explained why, then more people would have, rather than, you know, I think, I can't even remember when, you know, face coverings became mandated, even in Scotland, but you're way into the summer. Like, make a decision and explain to people why it's so important, and then just be consistent rather than saying, oh, it might be this, it might be that, or we're not quite sure if it's going to be effective. Well, actually get them to wear them now. And if it turns out further down the line it's not effective, then we can stop wearing them. I just don't understand, you know, the sort of humming and hawing. And actually, I think that the governments in the UK were ultimately contributed to people resisting it, because it took so long for a concrete decision to be made.
And that was one of the big differences between Scotland and the UK. You know, Nicola Sturgeon was always coming out every day with briefings and being clear on what was the latest thing. And you can always pick holes in, well, how can we go to the pub to 10 o'clock but not to 11 o'clock? And you can go around in circles with that kind of thing. But it was so different what's happening in England. If Boris Johnson would come out at a briefing and say, no, don't visit your friend's house. And then the next day, a journalist would ask Matt Hancock, and he'd say, "Well, I mean, you could go round if you've got a reason to go round." And it was just like they would backtrack, they would say things, and then immediately backtrack on them. And then that would get what Matt Hancock said would be thrown to another cabinet minister who would interpret that and say, "Oh, well, if it's an emergency, but maybe no, if it's important, or you know." And it was just a shambles, like, and a lot of that I think just came through the fact that I don't think Boris wanted the responsibility of being going out there every day and dealing with it. So he would pass it off to other people. And there's also the aspect that bothered me a lot during the lockdowns was the media, and the fact that how consistently the media would brought up in Scotland would broadcast UK rules that didn't apply. You know, and you could have, how could people not get confused when they've got the Scottish government saying what the rules are, that getting put out in the media, and then the media, without explaining the difference, just broadcasting what Boris was saying, even though it was talking about things that didn't apply in Scotland, or there was different rules. You know, like, to me, it was an emergency to the situation that the media should not have been allowed to broadcast UK-wide, England-only rules. When that happens for things like, I don't know, farming subsidies or some random thing like that, it can confuse people, but it's not that big a deal. But when that happens, when it's rules designed to keep people safe during a pandemic, it's criminal. It really is.
Yeah. One of the biggest differences between Scottish policy and English policy that I thought was highlighted on his whiteboard was a wee footnote at the bottom that says, "Who do we not save?" And I know that you go, oh, and that's why I spoke about a risk matrix earlier, because in the context of if you're trying to figure out the best thing to do, then yeah, maybe that somewhere down the bottom comes, you know, if we don't do this, this is going to happen. But that didn't seem to be England's main motivation of their rules. It was all about getting the pub open, getting people back to work. It wasn't really about saving people. And I think that's why that footnote, that no matter what it means and what context, their crazy mind map in this board to try and think like a Tory, you know, I think that it really was, how do they justify sacrificing folk? And I heard that it was 2/3 of deaths from coronavirus is disabled people. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, that's who they let die, the elderly and the infirm.
Yeah.
Sad.
And yet they've got the gall, Matt Hancock had the gall to say that they were trying to throw, they did throw a protective ring around care homes. I think what I think what the media has also perpetuated too, when it comes to care homes, is always looking at the standard care homes which older people live in. I don't think that they've been really good at communicating the diverse nature of social care. One of my friends who I was visiting down south, she works in a home with people with Down syndrome and severe learning difficulties. And the real issues that we had was about consent for these people who perhaps don't have the capacity to make decisions for themselves. And there was somebody who, had Down syndrome and became infected with COVID, and who was removed from that home and put somewhere else that which didn't know anyone. So if you can't explain what's happening to somebody, that's not, it's not okay. And if you think that throwing a protective ring around something is trying to stop people going into something and not, and that's it, it's not good enough. And we need to really talk about the rights of these people, to what extent do they have capacity? Because, somebody who cares for these people and has been caring for them for 14 years says they can tell you exactly what they want. You just need to communicate it in a certain way. And this is where I understand at the start there was panic. They were trying to, understand they were trying to execute these things and these different policies. But, by the time the second lockdown came around, there's ways and means of communicating with these people and asking them, what exactly do you want? If you've got somebody who's severely autistic and is happy being on their own, having a structured day-to-day, actually, the lockdown life for them has actually been relatively positive. They might be less stressed. But if you've got somebody who has Down syndrome and is really, really social and wants to go out and about, it's really detrimental to their well-being. When we talk about social care, yes, older people, it was really, really important and they were let down across the UK. But also we need to really reflect on what does social care actually mean and who has been let down so severely. And like you said, particularly people who are disabled and older people have been severely let down. And that's why I hope that the discussions around the National Care Service will prevent that from happening again and will actually really benefit the lives of these people in the social care sector right throughout.
Yeah, and that's, it was another thing that I've noticed in the media, that we're talking about a situation where somebody's, an insider's blowing the whistle to say the government was massively incompetent to the point where they've killed thousands and thousands of citizens. Yet a lot of the discussion in the media is, did you notice he didn't criticise Michael Gove? That must mean maybe he's supporting Michael. He wants Michael Gove to be the next prime. And you're like, this is gossip. That's political gossip. Yeah, that's what they'd rather talk about in the face of thousands of people dead. I mean,
this is the media though, over and over again. We're in another lockdown, and then pubs can reopen again, and we're like, well, you're in England. Are you allowed to have a Scotch egg as a meal, or do you have to have a meal so you can get a pint? And I'm like, can we please stop wasting time talking about this? You need to order a meal, right? It's up, eat something while you're having a drink if that's the rules, and stop faffing about with this, hair splitting. And then what you're saying there too about gossiping, well, he didn't slag off Rishi Sunak either, so does he want to be his pal in the future? So I don't really care. I'm probably more interested in saving lives at the moment, and if we want to sift through all this information afterwards, then we can. But it's the media just really bringing it all the way down to these silly, just superficial arguments. It's so frustrating.
And we're not out of it yet. That's the even more frustrating thing. Like, they're going on as if, we're all going off on a jolly summer holiday romp. And, it's like, what are yous talking about? There's still areas like Glasgow Southside that are really suffering from infection, where people are getting really sick and dying, and we're trying to focus on getting everybody jagged. And as you say, talking about, can I have a Scotch egg with my pint? Just buy a cheeseburger and chips or something. Have a meal.
What? But then, of course, when you say substantial meal, you're leaving it open to interpretation. If you want the pub landlord to be responsible for that, then say that. But you have to say, well, you need to order a certain meal, or you need to do this, or you need to do that. Be clear and be concise. And, there's always going to be ambiguities with these or things that appear to be really contradictory. So like you said earlier, David, pub shuts at 10 rather than 11 o'clock. Okay, these are the types of things that are just going to happen. But it's the same with the Glasgow thing too, because Glasgow City Council is under level three, but everywhere else round about it isn't. Well, there's no way, unfortunately, of breaking that down even further, because Scotland and the whole of the UK is really, really centralised, and we've got huge councils. So there's a problem, and that's that just re-emphasises the importance of having really good governance, but having really decentralised councils and municipal areas like they do in Spain. It's, you know, if you have smaller councils, you can react to things even better than what we have at the moment, because you've got some areas in Glasgow that have got like 3 cases per 100, and then you've got some that's, you know, ridiculously high. So, you know, that's an argument in itself for either more devolution and more decentralisation, so we can make those decisions and make things more targeted.
Yeah, it's quite depressing in the end. We started out so cheerful in terms of, you know, it's a sunny bank holiday, and now we're talking about thousands and thousands dead through government incompetence.
Yeah. Just terrible. Really terrible. And well, I think I got my angry voice on, so we'll stop doing that.
Well, we'll move on to our next point, which after just getting on a high horse about talking about political gossip, I suppose this is a wee bit gossipy in terms of it kind of came out of left field. I don't think anybody was really expecting it, but it was announced that the SNP and the Scottish Green Party are open negotiations about a cooperation agreement. It was very, very clear that nobody wants to use the word coalition, which I thought was interesting, but a cooperation agreement. We've got a mixture of Greens and SNP right here. So, Deborah, what was your thoughts when you heard the news?
Yeah, they probably didn't want to use the word coalition after it was tainted by the Lib Dems.
Do you think that's what it was?
Well, it's got negative connotations, doesn't it? But as I'm sure one of you are going to point out, it's against the Green sort of ethos, like to be in a formal coalition's very...
Yeah, well, there is... And I can't state exactly, but there is sort of things that have been passed over the years that would have to be resolved in order for the Greens to go into a coalition, because it is something that party members have always been aware of, that could be something that would happen in the future and might necessarily not be the best thing. So I do wonder if that's the reason that the word cooperation's not has been used rather than coalition, to sort of sidestep some of those issues.
Yeah, I'm just happy that the Greens are going to be in a power of influence over some of the policy that's going to come out Scottish Government. We need more Green policy. We need a wee bit of pressure leaning on the SNP. I know I do that from within, but it'll be nice to have honours. I'm quite pleased with it. I'm sure you two have got much more to say about it.
Brian, thoughts?
My first thoughts were, oh, geez. I didn't, you know, because there was a lot of rumours about it, you know, during the campaign and immediately after. And, you know, every time there was a Green being interviewed, there was one question was about a coalition. And they're just like, you know, Gillian McKay's just been elected the first ever MSP, you know, in Central Scotland. And we're talking about, are we going into coalition? Well, no, we're winning loads of seats. This is a good thing. Can we focus on this? But, yeah, it did. It came out of nowhere because it was done through a statement as well from the, you know, it wasn't like a, oh, we're going to have a chat and we'll see what happens. It was actually quite formalised through a statement. My first instincts were, I'm not going to prejudge what's going to come out of this, but I am potentially concerned about a cooperation. I saw Lorna Slater on the Sunday show this morning, and what she's talking about is perhaps, you know, talking about particular issues but not supporting them on others. So I'll be really interested to see what particular policy areas that is. I'm hoping it will be on things like climate. Hopefully it'll be on things like, you know, work, fair work, things like that. But I'm a little bit concerned about what that might actually look like. But I'm not going to go all guns blazing, but I just hope that the membership gets an opportunity to be involved. And they've got an opportunity to perhaps cast a vote on, you know, similar to the Irish Greens, where the coalition and the agreement was put out to the membership and they voted on it. But I hope that there is a vote, and I hope that there's an opportunity for us to debate it as a party.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the sort of Tory Lib Dem coalition, and I believe that their the Lib Dem membership was involved to the level of approve this or leave. So I think we'll hope and expect that the Greens will be a bit more sort of democratic than that. Personally, I was quite sceptical when I heard about it. I keep thinking I still can't really see where the benefit is for the Greens. It's a case of what influence could we have within this agreement that we couldn't have outside of the agreement?
Yeah.
If we're looking to exert pressure to force the SNP left, which is what we've always tried to do, how does being in this cooperation agreement help that? How does protesting about something behind closed doors, you know, put more pressure than saying or criticizing publicly?
I would argue that the publicly would actually have more of an impact. I think too that it's exactly what you're saying. I can't see how being in a coalition or an agreement or anything like that is going to be really beneficial for the party. I think I totally take what Deborah's saying, that you know it'd be good to see more cooperation. I think that the Greens have been pretty cooperative anyway as a small opposition party before. I think because it's really, really early doors, I think the conversation started this week. I just hope, like you said, I just hope that it's a lot more open, there's a lot more dialogue, and there's a proper vote from the memberships, and we can actually see what a full deal looks like, because I do feel some criticism towards my party when it comes to the budgets. I think it would have been good for members to be a little bit more included in that process before, when they were passing budgets.
Yeah, there's an aspect as well that, you know, if it's an agreement for sort of as like to support like the five budgets of the parliament, I mean, what concessions could the Greens get through that agreement that would be better than possibly five negotiations on five budgets?
Mm.
I don't want to be really super negative, because it has sort of just been announced. There's no details. But I struggle to see what the Greens could be offered that would change my mind. I mean,
yeah.
What level of sort of action would make you happy? Like if when a Green member was given a ministerial position, or what sort of concessions?
I don't really see what would be better than. Well, that's it. I can't think of any concessions that would change my mind. It's, I think the situation we have now where the Greens use their votes, you know, for issues that are important to them. I don't really want Greens in the cabinet. I mean, I mentioned last week that I felt it was a wee bit loss of... I was worried that it would dent our radicalism having a Green presiding officer, now potentially having Greens sitting in the cabinet as well. It was like, oh my God, we're heading towards becoming the establishment here.
So would you have preferred a sort of vote-on-vote, you know, agreement, or just as you were, yeah, just your own separate
kind of
party?
Handshake agreement, like kind of confidence and supply level that they've had before. Mm. I think it's worked in the last, you know, number of years, the situation, like... I don't think if it's no broke, don't fix it.
I think taking a step back and not thinking about it too much as a Green member, I think looking at it from how it might benefit the Scottish Parliament and the Scottish Government is it could be a really positive thing for trans rights. I think it could be a really positive thing for having a proper majority for independence, because then the UK government and the media can't say, oh yeah, but you don't have a majority. Well, actually, no, we do. And, you know, potentially on really radical things like passing policy for the recovery from the pandemic, but also on climate action. But again, going back to what David was saying, I think that they could actually do that in opposition. So, you know, it really just seems to be for an independence type thing that it might be a good thing to have that majority. And ironically, which is really, really funny, is I've seen loads and loads of Alba people raging about this on Twitter, which is one of the funniest things ever. And I feel like going, they literally just maxed the yes vote. Like, what?
Yeah.
They got a super majority. Well, not a super majority, but they've got, you know, a bigger majority. Like
a working so majority. Funny. A working majority.
Actual working majority. But I thought that was the funniest thing to come out of it, is the fact that, you know, they're just, you know, obviously still getting over their severe loss that they had. And now they're getting their worst case scenario. I think it was Wings Over Scotland said this is the worst case scenario before the election would be a Green SNP pact. And that's what we got.
Honest, so, this is sounding like the best argument I've heard so far for to do it.
Well, there you go. Let's just... piss them off that much. Yeah, they're absolutely raging.
I just like the fact that yous aren't that keen, because it makes them a bit, you know, the Greens a bit less radical and a bit more establishment. I like that.
Yeah, what I would say is, as I was asking, and it was the SNP that approached the Greens about it. So from the Green point of view, I don't think anybody really knows exactly what the agreement is. Maybe the SNP might, obviously, if they've approached, they must have an idea of the kind of agreement they're looking at. And this isn't going to be, they said that this would take months of negotiation before anything came out of it. So I suppose there's plenty of time to involve the membership to actually properly look at whatever the different aspects of the agreement. Maybe it'll give us some stuff to talk about in podcasts to come then over the next, don't know how many months.
Something to
plenty
fight
of it.
Something to fight about.
And yeah, but I think it's also important for us to remember too that the Scottish Parliament is designed to encourage cross-party working. You know, it's not, loads of people during the election were saying, oh, it's designed to not give a majority. That's not the case. It's not to produce a majority unless there's 51% plus on the vote. And because the SNP, at the top of my head, 48% or whatever it is they got in the kind of constituency vote, that has pretty much produced a result that is reflective of that 48, you know, whatever percent that they won. So, you know, us as a parliamentary democracy in Scotland, we encourage cross-party thinking and cross-party working. And this looks like that could be that in action. So it's important to bear that in mind too. It's not like Westminster where, you know, they just wanted to get a coalition so they could dominate and form a government with a majority. It's, you know, it could be a working coalition or cooperation agreement on certain policy areas, and that could be a positive thing depending on what they are.
Well, guys, I think this has been a good podcast. I just want to thank you for taking part, and we'll see you next week. Anybody that wants to follow us can find us at _ungagged on Twitter. We're also on Facebook. And if you've got any questions, you can email us at ungaggedleft@gmail.com and put in the subject line, Holyrood Podcast. So, Ian, thanks very much, guys. And I'll see you next week.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Like I said at the start of the show, it was also a sad week because we saw the death of the believed to be the last surviving member of the International Brigades that fought in the Spanish Civil War. His name was José Almudévar Mateu. He was born in Marseille in 1919, and he joined up to fight the Pablo Iglesias column at the age of 15 to fight the forces of international fascism, which were attacking the Spanish Republic. He was wounded at the Touriel front and spent 3 years as a prisoner of the Franco regime. I think we all have a duty to say thanks to the brave men and women that fought for the Republic and were the first to see the threat of fascism as the rest of the Western democracies stood by and let the Republic fall. Rest easy, Jose. This is for you.
Well, 10 years before I saw the light of morning, the comradeship of heroes was laid. From every corner of the world was sailing the 15th International Brigade. Well, they came to stand beside the Spanish people, to try to stem the rising fascist tides. Franco's eyes burned the powerful and wealthy, Frank Ryan's looking from the other side. Well, even the olives were bleeding, it's a battle for Madrid thundered on, putting hope against the force of evil, and brotherhood against the fascist class. Viva la King Sarregada, lo passerà the pleasure made the fight. And the Lancies a cry around the hillside, there's all the Miram tonight. Bobby Hillion was a church of iron pastor, from Killarney across the Pyrenees again. From Derry came the brave young Christian brother, who sent his reign and fought the fight in Spain. Some he moved in 17, died in Tugova. Raffi and Aki and to hold the gun. From Dublin to the Via de Grio, where he fought in his eye beneath the Spanish sun. All remember them tonight. Many Irishmen, they heard the call of Franco, join Hitler and join Mussolini too. Propaganda from the pulpits and newspaper helped up zombies even Mr. Blue shirt through. Well, the word came from the church support the Nazis, but a man in a collapse bear his boots again. When the frigate blessed the blue shut down in Galway, they sailed in the swastika of the Spain. Viva la King Sarregada, the old pastor and the pleasure made them fight. And the land takes the cry around the hillside, but it's only remembered of tonight. This song is a tribute to Frank Ryan, Kit Conway and Diddy Coney too, Heather Daly, Charlie Regan and Hugh Bonner. Oh, many died, I can't name but a few. Blaise of Brown and Danny Doyle and Charlie Donnelly, Lim Tomlinson and Jim Strenny from the Falls, Jack Doughty, Tommy Patton and Frank Conroy, Jim Foley, Tony Fox and Dick O'Neill. Look past the line of pleasure made from fights. By the land tickets to cry around the hillside. And that is all remembered of tonight. But viva la King Sarregada. Viva la King Sarregada. Viva la King Sarregada. And that is all remembered of tonight. Thank you very much, folks. You'll see you after the break.